as well as I used to, but obviously I've got a little bit of that Flemish going on. Right, thank you guys, Jules, Christoph, Guillaume, thank you all very much.
Thank you guys.
All right.
Julien Laurent, Christoph Terreur and Guillaume Balaguer with us on the EuroLeagues. You'll be able to listen to this as a podcast on BBC Sounds if you haven't already. It's 10 seconds to 10 o'clock, Johnny I. Anson. That is your gift.
You're too generous.
I gift you now 4 seconds. Don't waste it, will you?
I will use every moment of it. Thank you so much, Steve. Yes, hello, it's Johnny in for Gordon. Coming up on the programme, we'll cross live to the United Nations where Keir Starmer is speaking. We'll get analysis of that and, of course, the latest from Lebanon. Right now, let's get the news at 10 o'clock. That comes from Laura Harms.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Met Police says it'll look into whether anyone else committed criminal offences in relation to sexual abuse allegations against Mohamed Al-Fayed. Scotland Yard has also revealed there were 19 historical allegations that resulted in crimes being recorded involving Al-Fayed. They're alleged to have taken place between 1979 and 2013. Detectives have insisted that any victims will be supported in the best way possible. Dal Babu is a former Met chief superintendent.
They're beginning to realise how much damage this is happening on their watch now, albeit that these are historic matters. So the police will want to ensure that they are on top of this investigation and that they will deal with any individuals who may be allied, who may have been implicated in Al-Fayed's offending behaviour.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has told his country's military to keep fighting with full force in Lebanon. He's not responded to an international call for a 21-day ceasefire in fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. The Prime Minister will meet former President Donald Trump in the coming hours in New York. It will be the first time that Sir Keir Starmer has met the Republican presidential candidate. Our political editor Chris Mason has more.
The Prime Minister will head for Trump Tower shortly. He told us this evening that it was good to have the opportunity for talks with Donald Trump. "I'm a great believer in personal relations on the international stage," Sir Keir Starmer said, adding, "I think it really matters that you know who your counterpart is in any given country and know them personally, get to know them face to face." He is not meeting Mr. Trump's rival from the Democrats, the Vice President Kamala Harris, who is in Washington today. Sir Keir said he would like to speak to her, but there were the usual diary challenges. He has never met Kamala Harris either.
Well, meanwhile, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has met Joe Biden for talks at the White House and also had discussions with Kamala Harris. In a news conference, she said her support for Ukraine was unwavering. The Treasury is reconsidering Labour's manifesto promise to crack down on people who are registered overseas for tax purposes. It had been promised the policy would raise £1 billion, with the cash earmarked for extra NHS appointments as well as school breakfast clubs. But officials now believe the policy may not raise that amount or any money at all. And the TV presenter Nick Knowles has been cleared to perform on this weekend's Strictly. He had injured his arm and shoulder while changing a flat tyre on the way to a family party.
This is all smoke and mirrors. That's sales.
On BBC iPlayer.
What have you got to offer me?
Look, this is in all of our interests, right?
The new series of Industry.
I'm so glad you came.
Starring Kit Harington.
I'm an investment banker. Did you invite me here to watch you eat?
No, I invited you here to seduce you.
I've never met anyone with a bigger blind spot.
All's fair in love and war, right?
I needed my friend and you used me.
Industry.
Now, we go to work.
Starts Tuesday on BBC iPlayer.
Weeknights with Gordon Smart.
Well, it was meant to be, and it was so close to being Gordon Smart because he's made a brave, some would say foolish attempt to crawl back from his sick bed, but on medical advice, he's ducked back under the duvet. So get well soon, big man. So it's me, Johnny I. Anson, for your Thursday evening instead. It's a pleasure to be here, and I've loved having your company all week. One last time tonight. So from now until 11, we'll be across the big stories of the day as ever, including the Prime Minister, who's due to address the UN in New York soon. We are going to bring you that speech live when it happens, and we'll also be hearing from people either side of the Israel-Lebanese border as the fighting continues there. And we'll bring you more analysis on that conflict in a moment's time. After 11 tonight, it's a Northern Football Irish special as we look at two teams who can reasonably lay claim to the title of Sleeping Giant or Thriving Minnow. And from midnight, as we step over the threshold into Friday, we open up another book of the yearbook, another page, I should say, of the yearbook. If you want to guess which year we're talking about, it was the arrival of Pac-Man, the Sony Walkman, and most importantly in my house, the birth of the Crunchy Nut Cornflake. No Googling. It also was the year before I was born. That will help maybe my mum and dad and possibly my wife, but who knows. If you think you know which year we're focusing on, get in touch with your guesses and what you're up to as well at that time. The muckier story, the better. 85058 is the number to text, or you can get in touch on WhatsApp. It's 85058 909 693. And you can find us on Twitter or X. Just search at BBC Five Live or at Johnny I. Anson, if you're that way inclined with nothing better to do with your time. So it's 10:05, and let's get across the big news stories of the day. And that is that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has instructed the country's military to continue fighting against Hezbollah in Lebanon, despite growing calls for an immediate ceasefire. Today, the Israeli army says it's killed the head of Hezbollah's drone unit in a strike on a building in the southern suburbs of Beirut. The BBC's Anna Foster has been at the scene of an airstrike in the suburbs of the Lebanese capital.
You can see members of Hezbollah in the street, but you can also see that the army are here. You can hear the sound of sirens and ambulances that are arriving as well. Really, the chaos in the streets here. And of course, it really impacts the civilians who live in this area, their safety and security as well, when they see something like this happening very close to them.
Lebanon's health ministry says 40 people have been killed across the country in today's strike. The IDF have also attacked infrastructure on the border between Lebanon and Syria. Diplomatic efforts are continuing in New York, where the British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer is speaking at the UN shortly. Professor Victoria Honeyman is with us. We'll get her thoughts when we bring you that speech live. We're expecting it to happen in the next few minutes. We can see the lectern now. We can see the UN General Assembly. So when Sir Keir Starmer steps up there and starts talking, we'll bring that to you. Let's cross to Lebanon briefly, though. Olivia Lepoy-Devan joins us, a journalist and news editor at the independent newspaper L'Orient Today, based in Beirut. Good evening to you, Olivia. Thanks for being here again.
Good evening.
Escalation again today. What's been your experience? What have you been hearing and perhaps seeing on the ground in Beirut?
Yeah, well, in terms of Beirut, I was just walking, happened to just be walking in the streets, and I heard a rush of sirens, and I thought that must be probably another strike. And unfortunately, it was. That's the sixth strike now that we've seen since the conflict began last year on Beirut. That's the fourth strike in the space of a week on Beirut's southern suburbs, which, as you mentioned there, is both an area controlled by Hezbollah, but is also a totally normal residential area, very densely populated, full of civilians. And the reason why that strike took place was because Israel was targeting the head of Hezbollah's drone unit, Mohammed Hossein Sourour. Obviously, Hezbollah has been using drones for surveillance and also to potentially choose new targets for which they would aim their rockets and missiles at into northern Israel. And at the same time, we've seen on the Israeli side, strikes continue. The Israeli Air Force says it's hit around 220 Hezbollah targets. Meanwhile, what that means for ordinary people is yet again hundreds and thousands of people moving from the south up to Beirut and beyond, fleeing for safety, and people continue to move into the capital here, with churches, mosques, schools being turned overnight into shelters for people. And the government here is saying they're now estimating there's about 500,000 people displaced,
right.
And on top of that, 700 people killed within a week. So we're definitely at the most deadliest part of this conflict, but seemingly the mood music from diplomats doesn't seem good in terms of a potential political way out of this.
Yeah, I mean, we've heard calls from various people, including the UN and the likes of Sir Keir Starmer, and of course the American President Joe Biden too, of at least a 21-day ceasefire. Considering the rhetoric coming from Benjamin Netanyahu and this potentially increasing likelihood of a ground offensive, it seems incredibly unlikely that anybody, including Hezbollah, is going to heed those warnings and listen to those pleas for a ceasefire.
Yeah, I think this proposed deal doesn't answer either side's needs and desires. On the Israeli side, it doesn't give them the reassurance that they would wish for, that a short truce is going to stop Hezbollah from posing a real threat. Hezbollah being one of the best armed non-state actors in the world, with more than 100,000 missiles in its arsenal, very, very well trained as well during its fighting in Syria. So I don't think a short truce is going to reassure people, the government there, that it can safely return some of the 60,000 displaced people back to their homes. Likewise, on Hezbollah's side, they've been consistent throughout this conflict that they won't agree to any deal until there is a secured ceasefire deal in Gaza. That is because the reason why they're involved in this conflict in the first place is because they opened a front of support, as they call it, on October 8th following Hamas's assault on Israel. But equally, what we do know is Iran, Hezbollah's biggest backer, is reiterating its desire to stop this conflict, to at least de-escalate it, because it does not want to be dragged into an all-out war that goes against its own national interests. So there is a bit of pressure coming from Hezbollah's backer. Certainly the Lebanese government are putting pressure on the group as well. But in real terms, what we're seeing tonight from Benjamin Netanyahu, he tweeted just a couple of hours ago a picture of a fighter jet with the words in Hebrew saying, "We will speak in actions, not words." And we certainly haven't heard any signs yet that he's close to accepting a deal. But of course, we will see what comes from the meetings at the UN, where he is right now, along with Keir Starmer.
And Olivia, can I ask you, if you can, just to explain simply that the relevance of the Litani River, the UN is talking about this buffer zone between Israel and Hezbollah. What is the relevance of this area, and how likely is it that Hezbollah would be willing to concede it?
Yeah, so essentially this goes back to an agreement that was forged after 2006 war to create a blue line, which is kind of like a temporary border at the moment to separate Israel and southern Lebanon. And just above it, there is an area called the Litani River, a strategic point whereby Israel feels that below the Litani River, that is a satisfactory buffer zone in terms of pushing back the threat of Hezbollah, because if they can't access that area, it means they can't build rocket launchers that can then fire rockets and missiles easily into northern Israel. So the further that they're pushed back, the harder it is for Hezbollah to pose a real viable threat. But then, of course, on Hezbollah's side, they would say that they have been, on the whole, sticking to this agreement, and they feel the reason why they've been using that area and encroaching below south of the Litani River is because they feel there's been various encroachments on the Israeli side in recent years. This is obviously critical because, again, for any real sustainable deal to be made, that problem needs to be resolved in terms of creating a proper border that is agreed by both sides and observed. And again, this is something that will really help end the Lebanese context, but it is all in a way linked to Gaza. You can't really have one deal without the other, according to Hezbollah, certainly, but seemingly also Netanyahu on his side isn't really particularly favourable to a ceasefire in Gaza. So again, it's this kind of vicious circle of transience on both sides. And all we're seeing is every day the next step on this ladder of escalation.
And sadly, this probably won't be the last, will it? Olivia, thank you very much. Good to talk to you as ever.
Thank you so much.
That's Olivia Lepoy-Devan there, a journalist and news editor at the independent newspaper L'Orient Today, which is based in Beirut. We will cross live to the UN conference in a moment's time, where Keir Starmer will be giving that speech. And to help us go through it is the professor in British politics at the University of Leeds, Dr. Victoria Honeyman, who joins us live on the programme now. Hiya, Victoria. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, great to talk to you. Thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure.
I can see the Greek Prime Minister at the moment, still at the lectern. We are expecting Sir Keir Starmer in the next few minutes. So when that happens, we'll cross live and then we'll come back to you to get a bit of assessment of it. But if we could just, I guess, broadly speak about what he's doing there at the moment and just how big a moment this is for him. Obviously off the back of a bit of a tetchy conference, I think it's fair to say. How important, just from a prime ministerial point of view, will this appearance be?
These meetings, these kind of events are always hugely important for individuals because it presents them as international statespeople rather than the leader of the Labour government. It's about kind of presenting yourself as being bigger than your party political position and really being on the international stage. So Keir Starmer will really want to put his best foot forward anyway, but particularly because he's had a bad few weeks, this will be his opportunity to try and reset and look like the international statesman that he wants to.
Yeah, it feels like he's not going to pull any punches. He has appeared, obviously, in various discussions there and has attacked Russia, hasn't he? Asking how it dares to show its face, taking a very stern approach. Seems like he's setting his stall out there for the kind of statesman he wants to be seen as.
Indeed, and it's something that we also saw from David Lammy, the Foreign Secretary, very straightforward speaking in the terms of the United Nations, indicating that they see themselves in a very particular way, that the idea of Britain potentially backing away from international issues, that is simply not going to be the case. The message they will want to give out is Britain is willing to stand up and be counted. And we've already seen this with issues relating to Ukraine. And we'll certainly see more of this from Keir Starmer, essentially saying, we have a voice and this is what we want to do going forward. It's important for him because, again, he wants to create that impression of being an international statesperson, which all leaders do. It's important to them. You've got a whole rack of leaders there doing exactly the same.
Yeah, we'll just turn our attention just very briefly away from the Middle East. He's expected to meet Donald Trump as well, which will be interesting, especially off the back of the likes of the Home Office Minister Angela Eagle, who were told the Fringe event that he's been emboldening racists. This is Donald Trump, obviously. Mm-hmm. And Keir Starmer now really needing to play, I guess, a much more diplomatic game now he's not in opposition anymore.
That's right. To be fair, Keir Starmer's pretty good at the diplomatic game as it is anyway. But it's important for prime ministers to meet potential leaders of the United States and vice versa. You see very often that presidents and prime ministers will meet potential opponents, but kind of their opposite numbers when it comes to elections. This is not particularly new. It is interesting because it's Donald Trump, because there has been criticism of him, obviously, as you mentioned there. But it's pretty normal business for them to meet. You've got to think, if Donald Trump wins, Keir Starmer has to try and build a strong relationship with him in the same way that he would if it was Kamala Harris. So, yeah, he will certainly want to try and put his best foot forward. But we know from the Theresa May period that relationships with Donald Trump are not always the easiest to cultivate.
Yeah, it's just strikes me as what an odd job being prime minister is, from the from the party conference to then trying to, keep things sweet with the potential leader of America, to then castigating Russia, to then giving a speech to the UN General Assembly. I mean, you really do have to be able to grasp a lot of different topics when you're in charge of the country, don't you?
You do. It's not just those kind of issues which are key. It's not just your party management.
Let me jump in, Victoria, because he has just arrived at the lectern and is about
to address
the UN General Assembly.
Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I address the General Assembly today as someone with a deep belief in the principles of this body and the value of international cooperation. I remember reading the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as a student. It had a profound impact on me. I spent my career as a lawyer working to protect those rights. And the Declaration still inspires me now as Prime Minister, because it speaks about our inherent dignity, the very essence of what it is to be human, of equal and inalienable rights, based on a foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Yet as we meet here today, that can feel like a distant hope. Conflict touches more countries now than at any time in the history of this Assembly. Around the world, more fires are breaking out and burning with ever greater intensity, exacting a terrible toll in Gaza, Lebanon, Ukraine, Sudan, Myanmar, Yemen, and beyond. the vast majority of humanitarian need in the world today is driven by conflict. After 20 years of gains in tackling poverty, disease, and in health, war is one of the main regions that progress has stalled. That is a catastrophe made by human hands. It has weakened the cause of cooperation, so political division between North and South, and turned the geopolitical dial away from the rule of law towards brute force and aggression. And this matters to us all. It matters to the British people. My government was elected to change Britain, to deliver national missions on higher growth, safer streets, cleaner energy, more opportunity, and a healthier society. But behind every one of these missions sits another insight, something that used to be unspoken, but now needs to be said, that we recognise that our success in Britain can never be separated from events beyond our shores. Global challenges rebound on us at home. And to grapple only with the effects of war, poverty, climate change, pandemics, or irregular migration when they arrive on our doorstep is to set ourselves up to fail. We must work with others to solve these problems at root, to tackle the causes. Britain is stronger when we do so. So we are changing our approach on the global stage too. My message today is this. We are returning the UK to responsible global leadership because I think the international system can be better. We need it to be better. People talk about an age of polarisation, impunity, instability, an unravelling of the UN Charter. And I fear that a sense of fatalism has taken hold. But our task is to say, no, we won't accept this slide into greater and greater conflict, instability, and injustice. Instead, we will do all we can to change it. This is the moment to reassert fundamental principles and our willingness to defend them, to recommit to the UN, to internationalism, to the rule of law, to work together for peace, progress and equality. Because it is right, yes, absolutely. But also because it is plainly in our self-interest. So we are ready to step up in a spirit of respect and equal partnership. I don't claim that solving these problems is easy, but there are positive, practical things that we can do together. This starts with addressing the rising tide of conflict and preventing a regional war in the Middle East. I call on Israel and Hezbollah, stop the violence. Step back from the brink. We need to see an immediate ceasefire to provide space for a diplomatic settlement. And we are working with all partners to that end. Because further escalation serves no one. It offers nothing but more suffering for innocent people on all sides and the prospect of a wider war that no one can control and with consequences that none of us can foresee. This is intimately linked with the situation in Gaza, where again we need to see an immediate ceasefire. It shames us all that the suffering in Gaza continues to grow. The answer is diplomacy, the release of all the hostages and the unfettered flow of aid to those in need. That is the only way to break this devastating cycle of violence and begin the journey towards a political solution for the long term, which delivers the long-promised Palestinian state alongside a safe and secure Israel. We must also work together for peace in Sudan and a proper response to the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today. We need to see greater action to deliver aid and to deliver peace. The world cannot look away. And we must stand up for international law. And that's why we are so resolute in our support for Ukraine. They are exercising their right to self-defense as provided for under the UN Charter and recognized by 141 members of this Assembly. We will stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes, because the alternative would be to confirm the worst claims about this place, that international law is merely a paper tiger and that aggressors can do what they will. We will never let that happen, because it is our duty to respond to a more dangerous world with strength, to keep our people safe. But alone, that's not enough. That's not the limit of our responsibility. We must also work together to make the world less dangerous. And so we have to face some hard truths. The institutions of peace are struggling, underfunded, under pressure, and over-politicized. The entire framework of arms control and counter-proliferation, painstakingly constructed after decades, has begun to fall away. Iran continues to expand its nuclear activity in violation of its international commitments. Incredible new technologies like AI are being deployed for military use without agreed rules. These are difficult challenges to grip and too urgent to ignore. That's why the new Pact for the Future is so important. We must put new energy and creativity into conflict resolution and conflict prevention, reverse the trend towards ever greater violence, make the institutions of peace fit for purpose, and hold members to their commitments under the UN Charter. But again, reducing conflict is not the limit of our responsibility. Other global challenges impact us too. So we must work to get the SDGs back on track. So, Mr. President, under my leadership, the UK will lead again, tackling climate change at home and internationally, and restoring our commitment to international development. Like many of you, in a few weeks' time, I will be travelling to Samoa for the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting, where a generation of children are having to contemplate fleeing their island of their birth for good. The threat of climate change is existential, and it's happening in the here and now. So we have to reset Britain's approach. We have lifted the de facto ban on onshore wind in England, ended new oil and gas licences, and created Great British Energy as we become the first major economy to transition to clean power by 2030. And I'm pleased to tell you that, yes, we will meet our net zero target, backed up with an ambitious NDC at COP29, consistent with limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. And we'll support others to do the same. I know that finance is at the heart of this, so the UK will continue to be a leading contributor to international climate finance that includes supporting nature and forests, because this is vital for biodiversity and reducing emissions. And it includes funding for climate adaptation, because those who did not cause this crisis should not be left to cope with the consequences. And the UK will also continue to be a leading contributor to development, committed to returning to 0.7% when fiscal circumstances allow. But let's be frank. Public finance will never fully meet the needs, so we must use it as a multiplier to unlock much greater levels of private investment. And we have already started this work. I can announce today that we're creating a new facility, the British International Investment, which will work with the City of London to mobilise billions in pension and insurance funds to invest in boosting development and fighting climate change. This is a great British innovation. And if we're going to deliver in each of the areas I've talked about today, with all the benefits that we'll bring, then this is the kind of approach that we need to take. Innovating, thinking differently, moving faster, and being ready to change how we do things in three key areas. First, we must change the international financial system to deliver a fairer deal for developing countries. We will use our seat on the boards of the IMF and the World Bank to argue for a bolder approach to tackle unsustainable debt, which is compounding poverty and inequality, depriving the sick of healthcare and children of education. We must tackle the barriers to investment, which choke off the flow of private finance. And we must put a price on the true cost of emissions through a new levy on global shipping, with the proceeds going to tackle climate change and cut emissions even further. Crucially, we need to accelerate reform of the multilateral development banks so that they shoulder more risk, unlocking hundreds of billions more to help the poorest and build a low-carbon global economy. A critical milestone in the fight against poverty is approaching, with the replenishment of the International Development Association. This is the chance for everyone to show greater ambition so the IDA can be a bigger and better, helping more people, especially those in fragile states and conflict zones. On that basis, we will be ambitious too. We will increase our pledge and play our part in seizing the potential of this moment. Second, if we want the system to deliver for the poorest and most vulnerable, then their voices must be heard. We need to make the system more representative and more responsive to those who need it most. So we will make the case, not just for fairer outcomes, but fairer representation in how we reach them. And this also applies to the Security Council. It has to change to become a more representative body, willing to act, not paralysed by politics. We want to see permanent African representation on the Council. Brazil, India, Japan and Germany as permanent members. And more seats for elected members as well. Finally, to support this, we will also change how the UK does things, moving from the paternalism of the past towards partnership for the future. Listening a lot more, speaking a bit less, offering game-changing British expertise, and working together in the spirit of equal respect. Joining the Paris Pact for People and Planet, pursuing a new global clean power allowance, standing for the new term on the Human Rights Council, and joining forces to tackle the toughest challenges, like antimicrobial resistance, preparedness for the next pandemic, and outbreaks of deadly diseases like Mpox. We are ready to work with all UN members, because the scale of the challenges we face demands it, and our prosperity and security depends on it. I say it again, all this matters to Britain. Mr. President, by tackling conflict, making progress in the fight against climate change and poverty, and reforming the international system so that it's fit for the 21st century, we can realise the hope and the promise that shine through the founding documents of this organisation. Together, in all our interests, we can change direction from the dangerous, destructive path we find ourselves on and turn instead towards the rule of law, towards cooperation, responsibility and progress, towards peace. Thank you. Thank you.
So that was the speech of Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, at the UN General Assembly. Let's bring back in Dr. Victoria Honeyman, Associate Professor in British Politics at the University of Leeds. It's been listening to that and reading along word for word. There's a lot to go at, Victoria, so I'm not going to get you to assess every single word of it. But broadly, firstly, what did you make of the speech and actually the way in which it was delivered?
It was delivered with a great deal of gravitas, as you would expect. There were an awful lot of references to the rule of law. Again, what you would expect. Some interesting things were in there. So, for example, a mention of Sudan and the conflict there, which is not mentioned very often.
I noted that exact thing down.
Indeed.
There are a lot of people that would have been expecting, obviously, what was happening in the Middle East and Ukraine.
Exactly.
I think that was a surprise to crop up there.
I think so. There were a couple of others. International Development Aid got a mention, and the idea of going back to 0.7%, about how you can do that collaboratively. That was really interesting. Obviously, discussion about climate change, and then about some more domestic policies. So issues relating to Great British Power, for example, were also mentioned. So I think that it was a very well-considered speech. It was delivered very well with the kind of the necessary tone. But it was also very conciliatory, the idea that Britain will, you know, listen a bit more, talk a bit less. I think that will be a message that will go down pretty well with quite a lot of members.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Did you think that was a thinly veiled swipe at the previous administration?
Possibly, but to be honest with you, I mean, it could be referring to Britain's general kind of post-Second World War position. I mean, you've got to think, he was talking about attending the Commonwealth Heads of State meeting in Samoa. Britain has a colonial past that it cannot and should not kind of run away from. So it could have been a thinly veiled swipe at the previous administration, but it could have been a swipe at virtually any administration that's been in power since 1945, to be completely honest with you. The idea of Britain working more collaboratively is important.
Let's talk about the addressing conflict. A few things to go out there. Unsurprisingly calling for a ceasefire. Which I think, you know, he had to say, regardless or not of whether he thinks Hezbollah and Netanyahu is going to listen to that. Interestingly, though, talking about the need for a Palestinian state along Israel, do you think that the language there was significant?
The situation that Britain finds itself in and that Keir Starmer finds itself in is difficult when it comes to Israel. It's difficult because realistically Britain isn't driving the policy in that part of the world, and it's essentially been driven by Israel and primarily the United States. Britain therefore finds itself somewhat boxed in on Israel because there's only so far that it can go before it begins to upset its major international ally. So I think it was interesting that he called for a ceasefire, as you say, he was expected to do so. But to talk about the two-state solution, that is generally considered in a number of areas to be the only viable solution. But you could argue that he stepped a little further than maybe he might have been expected to. But he wasn't suggesting anything particularly revolutionary. I think that he'll get away with that. I don't think there'll be any particular kind of kickback from the American administration about that.
Talking about Ukraine, standing for as long as it takes, because the alternative would be to confirm the worst about this place, that international law is merely a paper tiger. Again, not surprising, supporting Ukraine, but maybe, I mean, Ukraine will certainly be happy to hear that phrase, as long as it takes. You know, we are in this for the long haul.
That's right. And I noticed that Biden has, presidential officer put out a number of tweets about the fact that the American president is going to be making more supportive measures to Ukraine going forward. I think that it sends all of the right signals to the Ukrainian leadership and also to Putin, particularly if you think about what Donald Trump has been saying about his position with what he would do in his first days were he to win an American presidential election, of bringing together Putin and the kind of the Ukrainian authorities and demanding that they make a deal. So I think it'll set the right tone. And it's pretty much what is expected of a British prime minister in these set of circumstances.
Yeah. And unsurprisingly, talking about climate change as well, reflecting Britain's approach, we've lifted the de facto ban on onshore wind, ended new oil and gas licenses. But then as well, talking about this 3-point plan to try and end poverty, but also connecting that to fighting climate change as well. Obviously, you know, as well as the conflict that's happening in the Middle East and Russia, climate change is really becoming a central tenet of his approach to things at the moment.
That's right. It was very interesting the way that it was positioned. I've heard Harriet Harman speak about this before, about the idea of the Labour Party being concerned about people who live in poverty, wherever they may be. And there were certain overtones of that to the speech about the idea that poverty is often the kind of the result of conflict and environmental damage, but also then causes its own set of problems, and that you need to tackle all of those things at once. And there were certain overtones in that speech. That was a very interesting kind of Labour parallel there.
So overall, do you think that he'll be happy with how it went? Will he be the statesman that he hopes he projected himself to be?
I think he'll be pretty happy with it. Just one quick thing that I wanted to mention. It was very interesting where he was talking about the membership of the UN Security Council, because I think that will be something that that he'll want to kind of unveil, I suppose. That is something that has been talked about by previous Labour leaders, but it's actually almost impossible for, in fact, impossible for one country to do it. You would have to get all members of the UN Security Council to agree to a change of personnel. But again, it sends the right signals in Brazil, Japan, Germany, and a number of African states about the idea that you want to widen out your message. So I think he'll be happy with how he delivered it. I think he'll be happy that he's done the job that he needs to do. And I think that he'll be hoping that it will go down very well in a number of different places about the idea that Britain is listening to other people rather than potentially kind of demanding things per se.
Yeah, you can see the headlines tomorrow, can't you? Listening more, speaking a bit less. I think that
absolutely.
Is, you're absolutely right. I think that's a phrase that's going to be used time and time again. Always great to talk to you, Victoria.
Oh, my pleasure.
Great to have you on the show. Dr. Victoria Honeyman, Associate Professor in British Politics at the University of Leeds. Thanks very much, Victoria. Let's get your latest update now. 20 to 10, that comes from 20 to 11, I should say. That comes from Matty Nixon.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Thanks, Johnny. Sir Keir Starmer is due to meet with Donald Trump for the first time a little later. As we've been hearing, the Prime Minister is in New York for the UN General Assembly. He'll now head to Trump Tower to meet the Republican presidential hopeful. Benjamin Netanyahu has also arrived in New York as international pressure grows for a ceasefire with the Lebanese militant group Hezbollah. The Israeli Prime Minister has already rejected the idea of a 21-day truce, despite the US insisting that the ceasefire proposal was coordinated with Israel. The Met Police says they'll look into whether anyone else may have committed crimes related to the allegations of sexual offences by Mohammed Al-Fayed. The force said between 2005 and 2023, 19 women came forward to make complaints about his behaviour towards them. And Naomi Campbell has been banned from being a charity trustee after a watchdog found funds were misspent on luxury hotels and spa treatments. A charity commission inquiry found Fashion for Relief was not passing on as much of the money raised as it was supposed to. On to sport now, and let's start in the Europa League, where 10-man Tottenham beat Azerbaijani side Karabakh 3-0 in their opening game in this season's competition. Elsewhere, Rangers were 2-0 winners at Malmo in their league stage opener in Sweden. Celtic are the first Scottish side to qualify for the Women's Champions League group stages since it was introduced in the 2020-21 season. A 2-0 win on the night and 3-0 aggregate victory against the Ukrainian side Voskla Poltava was enough for them to go through. Manchester City and Arsenal also progressed to the group stages. The Gunners overturned a 1-0 first leg deficit to beat the Swedish side Häcken 4-1 on aggregate, while City picked up a 3-0 victory against Paris FC to win the tie 8-0 over two legs. In cricket, the pace bowler Josh Hull has been ruled out of England's tour of Pakistan with a quad injury. England have opted not to call up a replacement. And the RB Formula One team has confirmed that they are dropping Australian driver Daniel Ricciardo for the final six races of the season. He'll be replaced by the New Zealander Liam Lawson.
Hello, I'm Nihal Arthanaika. Headliners. We go deep with the biggest names in entertainment, culture and the arts. And I'm not trying to boast here, but look, it is what it is. Huge guests.
The comedian's comedian, Stuart Lee.
I was going to be a stand-up comedian, but I would be different to the others because I would only tell the truth.
Headliners with Nihal Arthanaika. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, it's Johnny Iannson here on a Thursday evening in for Gordon for the last time this week. And we're going to get two very interesting perspectives now from both sides of the Lebanese border. Because as we've been hearing, Israel has rejected calls for a 21-day ceasefire with Hezbollah as airstrikes continue today into both Lebanon and northern Israel. On both sides of the border, there are, of course, thousands of civilians who are living amongst this and are now
very, very uncertain, scared about their future. Ilan Shayfeld is a poet and activist who lives in Tuval in northern Israel, about 18 kilometres from the border with Lebanon. The area has regularly been hit by rockets fired from Lebanon. He told me firsthand about the shelter built into his house.
Yes, every house in Israel has to have a shelter, the new houses. And I do have a new house. So we do have a shelter. The shelter is my room. This is my bedroom. But we have only 30 seconds to run into the shelter. And my boys sleep upstairs. So every time there's a siren, they have to quickly run away, even if they are in the midst of their sleep, to my room, to the shelter. And that's stressful, you know. And they also they cannot go to school for a week long. They study by Zoom only. I hardly give them the permission to go outside because I'm frightened that they might be hit by a rocket or by our rocket, you know, trying to take off theirs.
How old are your children?
12 years old.
I mean, that must be terrifying for them. How do they deal with the stress of rockets and planes overhead on a daily basis?
They play all day long. They play Future on the computer. So they try to not to think about it. But I have to be alert. And every time something might happen, I tell them about it and I prepare them to run away. You know, 1 year ago, I prepared my kids that in a matter of case, if I'm dead, they will have to take bags with water and money and run away to the fields. I'm seriously, that's what I told them. Today, I'm telling them that in a minute they hear a siren, they have to come down to the shelter. That's life here, but we have no other choice. We have to solve it.
I cannot fathom having to have a little girl. I can't imagine having those conversations with her. I don't know how you do that as a father, to say, if I'm not here, you need to take money.
Yes. It's terrible. I tell you what, I also wrote a children's book, especially for kids that lost their families. I just took it out for freely, I mean, with no royalties. I published it and I gave it freely to all the education system in Israel to be spread for the kids that lost their parents or their dads during the war.
How do you feel about what you're watching unfold to the north of the border, Ilan? We've heard from Benjamin Netanyahu again, who has said that the military will fight with the full force. There's been indications there will be a ground incursion. How does that make you feel?
I tell you something, when I was 21, just the minute I left the army after my service, the first Lebanon war began. That time, I was one of the first poets who went outside against the war. I wrote very militant anti-war poetry. But today, things are different. In the last 20 years, Hezbollah built the Shi'i villages in southern Lebanon. And many of the houses are actually built upon missiles. You know? They brought the Shi'is to southern Lebanon, promising them life, but giving them missiles inside of their homes. So those homes must be destroyed. And we must be sure that before a ceasefire, Hezbollah will be hit in such a way that he will lose his dream to conquer Israel, and that Iran will lose her fantasy about the fire ring around Israel.
Do you have sympathy for the people in Lebanon, though? And I'm not talking about Hezbollah, I'm talking about those people that you talk about who have had rockets put in their basements and who are the innocent civilians in this.
No, they are not innocent. I mean, the people who live with metal in their house are not innocent civilians. Let's begin with that. I do have sympathy for the Lebanese. I'm very sorry that we do not have a peace agreement with Lebanon. Lebanon is a beautiful country. The people of Lebanon are wonderful people. And, you know, being gay, I see the gay Lebanese man on Gaydar, and I have a fantasy about having a very huge gay party on the border. I mean, really, we can bring peace to this region. I mean, I really do want peace, but we must finish this thing because for 11 months, Hezbollah is being fires rockets on Israel. More than 100,000 Israelis have been evacuated from their homes. Some of them are my creative writing students. I know them in person. People are living all over in hotels, in family members' houses. Their houses are being crashed and burnt, and they have nowhere to go back to. So this must be finished.
Ilan, though, is there a part of you, though, that thinks the conclusion to this is through diplomatic means and negotiation? Because there are very, very few conflicts that end successfully purely through military options. And I can only try and imagine what it's like to live within 18 kilometres of someone who's firing a rocket at you and your neighbours and your community. But is there a part of you that also thinks that there has to be diplomatic negotiations
to solve this? Of course, more than that. I believe in the two-state solution.
Right.
I believe that the negotiation will be, at the same time, it should be with Gaza and with the Hezbollah and with the Palestinian Authority. We have to solve this Israeli-Palestinian conflict once and for all. But for now, I mean, during the following days, there should be a diplomatic solution, but it can be done only after we ensure our safety.
Okay.
And that means going into Lebanon at least half a kilometer up the mountains. At least half a kilometer. I'm not talking about 40 kilometers. But we must ensure the safety of the people of Israel.
Ilan, thank you very much for your time this evening. I hope that there is some sort of peace, and I hope that happens soon for you and your family and obviously for people on both sides of the border. And I appreciate your time in speaking to us tonight.
Thank you. And please let the people of Lebanon know that we are a nation that wants peace. We have beautiful views in both sides of the border. Let's live in peace.
Well, just after I spoke to Ilan, I spoke to Nadine Mashoub. She's on the other side of the border in Beirut.
Well, let's start where I live. I live in Beirut, in the east suburbs of Beirut, which is very close to the southern suburb of Beirut, which is very close to Dahiyeh, the hub of Hezbollah, let's say. The how to live in Beirut, I can tell you it's like we are living in a shaking big bubble. We cannot expect anything. Everything is unpredictable. We are under attack all the time. While talking now, there are raids and strikes over some cities in Lebanon in the south and on other region as well. And we are passing the day just waiting for something to happen. So this is how we are living. We are trying our best to overcome day by day. And to support in solidarity, to support all the families displaced that, who fled from their villages and homes to a safest area, which is Beirut. And now you can tell that Beirut is over squeezed with everything is happening.
And what keeps you there, Nadine? Could you go somewhere else? Could you leave Beirut?
Even if I leave Beirut, first of all, this is where I live. Second of all, not a region is safe. The Israeli side is saying that they are attacking Hezbollah, but they are attacking Hezbollah everywhere in Lebanon, in every corner, every village, everywhere. Okay? So, at the end, this is my country. This is where I want to live. And I have a duty now towards my fellow citizen to support and to help whenever the help is needed. Mm. Despite the political opinion, despite if a huge, I will not say the majority of the Lebanese, but a huge part of the Lebanese are against Lebanon having this war or conducting this war to support any other city like Gaza or to support any other war, we are forced now to deal with the issues that we are facing on a daily basis because of the war. Again, because at the end of the day, we are all under attack.
And can I just explore that a little bit more with you, Nadine, about the relationship with Hezbollah and how people feel towards them now, considering it is them that Israel is attacking, but undeniably killing civilians in the meantime? Is there growing anger towards Hezbollah within the country? And how are people living amongst those that belong to that organization?
Okay, let me be very, very extremely honest with you. Honestly, when we have this tension and this war, we usually, as Lebanese, this is how we function. We put everything, all the arguments, all the disputes, everything, we put the problems, we put them aside, and we start helping each other to overcome the issue that we are facing. Any talks about the politics or the feeling that we have towards any organization in Lebanon will come later. And this is, I'm being very honest, because now you can find a lot of NGOs, a lot of people, they are presenting themselves as volunteer and they are against the policy of Hezbollah. They are against this war, but they are working as volunteers to help the displaced families. Now, I am going to ask a question in general. Do you think the 100,000 family who flee their villages, left their homes, their villages, their work, to come to a safer area, if they wanted to die, it would have been better for them to stay in their villages and die? At the end of the day, it's a human feeling to feel like I want to live, and I will look instinctively, I will look to find a safer area for me and for my children.
Is there such a thing as a daily life or a normal life there, Nadine, at the moment? Can you go to the shops and are the card machines working? Can you get money from the bank? Can you do any normal things?
Very basic normal things. Right. Of course, the banks are working. A few shops are still open. I mean, the nightlife that you saw on social media 10 days ago stopped. Of course, the restaurants, they are barely working. We are living the basic life. Just we can find the pharmacy, of course, the hospital, the medical system is on alert because they are the first one to accommodate all the injuries, the casualties and everything. So, but it is a basic life.
Just before we let you go, Nadine, I've just spoken to an Israeli citizen who's 18 kilometres from the border, so just south of you, and he said, if we speak to anybody in Lebanon, my message would be that we all just want peace. What do you think when you hear that from somebody in Israel who's only a few miles away from you?
This is very critical what you are asking me. First of all, I don't consider this person who you were spoken with as an enemy on the human level, okay? But the Israeli government, the Israeli, is our enemy as Lebanese in general. In general, it's not the first time that they are invading our country. It's not the first time. It started 70 years ago, and it continues. I cannot judge the person you spoke to. I cannot judge. On a human level, definitely, Definitely, everyone, everywhere wants to live in peace. But to live in peace, there are rules and conditions. You cannot invade countries, take lands of others, and then pretend that you want to live in peace. We, as Lebanese, we are staying in our country. We didn't go, we didn't invade any. On the contrary, we have lands still under occupation. And here I'm talking as a Lebanese. We still have lands under occupation. And until this is solved, I cannot consider the other side a friend. They are enemies.
Okay.
Did you get my point?
I do. Of course I do. And I can only try and imagine what it's like for both of you living where you are right now and going through what you're both going through. Thank you very much for your time this evening, Nadine. Look after yourself. And,
thank you so much.
And stay safe. I really appreciate you speaking to us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Nadine. Take care.
Bye.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Justine Green. Sir Keir Starmer has called for an immediate ceasefire between Israel and the militant group Hezbollah, an idea that the Israeli government has apparently rejected. Addressing the UN General Assembly in New York in the past hour, the Prime Minister warned of a wider war if hostilities were allowed to continue.
I call on Israel and Hezbollah, stop the violence. Step back from the brink. We need to see an immediate ceasefire to provide space for a diplomatic settlement, because further escalation serves no one. It offers nothing but more suffering for innocent people on all sides.
The US Vice President Kamala Harris has promised unwavering support for Ukraine after meeting its leader Volodymyr Zelensky. Earlier, Washington released an $8 billion package to help Ukraine resist Russia's invasion. At a news conference tonight, Ms. Harris said it was in the interest of the US to help its allies resist Russian aggression.
History has shown us if we allow aggressors like Putin to take land with impunity, they keep going. And Putin could set his sights on Poland, the Baltic states, and other NATO allies.
The Metropolitan Police said they'll look into whether or not anyone else should be pursued for criminal offences following abuse allegations against the former Harrods owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. The force said between 2005 and 2023, 19 women had come forward to make complaints about his behaviour towards them. The Treasury has raised concerns that the government's plan to clamp down on non-dom tax status would not raise as much money as thought. Labour hoped its manifesto pledge would raise £1 billion, but the Treasury fears rich foreigners could simply leave the UK rather than pay more tax. The model Naomi Campbell has been banned from being a charity trustee for 5 years. The regulator found widespread financial misconduct at her anti-poverty charity Fashion for Relief. She's insisted all the money she raises goes to charity. The podcast Just One Thing, presented by the late Dr. Michael Mosley, has been celebrated at the British Podcast Awards. The BBC Radio